Hebrews 12, verses 1 through 11. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood. And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves, and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it.
This week in this passage, as I mentioned, has been a doozy. We've said over and over again that this is a letter written to a group of people who are suffering, who are experiencing hardship. They've just converted out of Judaism to Christianity, and they're getting all kind of flack and just persecution for it. And it's about to get really bad, and even our passage alludes to it a little bit. Because of that, I can resonate, and we all can resonate. I'm looking at many of you who are going through really hard times and who have, and so this is something that we can all hear and listen to and learn from, thankfully. I've mentioned this a lot over the last 15 months, that Elizabeth Elliot wrote a book, Suffering is Never for Nothing, and it was very helpful for our family as a woman who really walked through intense suffering. And she has a great definition of suffering that I absolutely love, the clarity that it brings. But she says that suffering is having something that you don't want or wanting something that you don't have. And because of that, all of us are sufferers, because there's things in all of our lives that we want and we don't have. And there's things in our lives that we have and we desperately don't want to have them anymore. Now, because of this, granted, the intensity of our suffering varies from time to time. We're not suffering intensely all the time. There's times when things are going well, life is going well, we're enjoying our jobs, we're enjoying our friendships and our relationships, and things are just good. But there are other times that they're not. There's other times in our lives that, in a sense, we're like Sam Greenfield from the movie Luck. And I don't know if you've seen this. This is a movie that just came out on Apple TV in August. My kids and I watched it, and it's about a girl named Sam, and Sam is deemed the unluckiest person in the world. The tagline to the movie is, for Sam, every day is just one of those days. And everything in Sam's life goes wrong. Whether it's her toaster doesn't work, she's late for work, she gets locked in her bathroom, or she bumps her head. Just whatever can happen would happen to her. It's almost like she's constantly stuck in a state of Murphy's Law, that whatever, if it can go bad, it's going to go bad. And it does go bad. And it continues to go bad for her until Sam finds a lucky penny. And when she gets this penny, she doesn't have any more bad luck. Life actually tends to work out for her until her bad luck yet again prevails and she loses the penny. And so for the rest of the movie, she goes all throughout her life in different places looking for this penny, just thinking if she could just find this lucky penny, that it would end her unluckiness, or to borrow on the language from the book of Hebrews, it would end her suffering. Now, we tend to approach life in the same way. Using Elizabeth Elliot's definition, there's typically one thing in our life that we think, if we had it, just this one thing that I don't have, then we would be fulfilled. Or we tend to think that there's something that if I could just get rid of it, then my life would be better, right? So we think about on the positive side, we think about, well, if I just had more money, I would have security, I would be happy, I would be fulfilled. Or you think if you just had this love, this relationship that you so desperately want, then that's all you would ever need and everything would be fine. Now, at the same time, you may think, well, there's a relationship that if I could just get rid of it, then life would be good, right? That one person that drives you crazy, and if that person would just go away, I would be happy. Or maybe there's an illness that you have, and you think, if I could just get rid of this illness that I'm carrying, then I would finally be happy. Now, I know this is true, because first, I know my own heart. My heart is an idol factory, and constantly, I've done this my entire life, I think, if I could just have this, then I would be happy. Or if I could just get rid of this, then I would be happy. But I also know this is true, because I'm looking at you, and I know so many of your stories, and I know there's things in your life that you hate, that you don't want to have anymore. And I know that there's things in your life that you want. And so often in my job, I talk to people and they come to me and they're suffering and they're just trying to find a way to alleviate the pain, almost as if they're looking for that magic penny, not to be silly about it. But if I could just figure out how to make this stop. Now, at the same time, I know this to be true because to borrow from Jesus loves me, for the Bible tells me so. Jesus himself so famously told us in John 16, I have said these things to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation. But take heart, I have overcome the world. In this world we will have suffering. That is guaranteed. And we all know this to be true. But here's the problem. And maybe our biggest problem as we face our suffering, oftentimes we don't look to the one who overcame the world. Instead, we look to things in this world that are going to eventually overcome us. They're going to get the best of us. Things like I just mentioned, whether it's money, whether it's relationships, whether it's our reputation, it could be a number of things. But they will never give us the hope and the relief from our suffering that we ask them to give us. Even good things, even the best things, they're not the ultimate thing. And so the writer of Hebrews, writing to the suffering church, in writing to us, is pointing us to the ultimate thing, to the ultimate person, Jesus Christ, telling us, no matter where we are, if we put our faith in Jesus, if we hold tight to him, then we can endure our suffering, that we can get through it, that we can find relief from it, even in a world full of pain and suffering and disappointment. This morning, the author of Hebrews, as Graham read, maybe you've heard before, is telling us that life is a race, that that's the metaphor he uses for this journey that we're going down. And in looking at this passage, we're going to see three things. First, we're going to see what I just said, life is a race. Secondly, we're going to see where is God in the race? Where is his place in the race that we're running? And then thirdly, we're going to look at practically how do we do it? How do we run this race in our life? Now, the language of life as a race is very common. The Apostle Paul says the very same thing to his protege Timothy near the end of his life, where he said this, I've fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. And the author of Hebrews is using the same exact language. And so let's jump in. Let's look at our first point. Life is a race. And we see this. We see that life is a race. And we see it, to use a racing analogy, right out of the gate, in chapter 12, verse 1, where the author says this, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. So the passage that Graham read, our passage this morning, it starts out by kind of looking backwards at chapter 11, where the author of Hebrews is talking about all these people who have successfully run the race, or to borrow on Paul's language, who have kept the faith. And he says that we are surrounded by them. Again, to use a racing analogy, like spectators in the stand, cheering us on, rooting us on as we run our race. So the question is, what is the race? And why does he use this analogy? Well, he's got this really interesting play on words as he's describing it in the original language. And it's really kind of a double meaning that we're going to see. First, the word race in the original language is the word agon, which means a conflict or a fight. It's where we get our word agony. And so he points out that we all run, right? He doesn't say that some people run it, some people don't. He says that we all run this race of life and this race of life is agony. As Jesus said, in this world we will have suffering. But at the same time, the word agon means a fight or a competition. In fact, the 2 Timothy passage we just looked at, when Paul said that I have fought the good fight, I have run the race, when he says race, he doesn't actually use agon, but he uses the word agon for fight. And so it's a battle. It's a fight. As I was studying the commentaries this week, most commentators believe that the author is referring to the pentathlon. Five races, okay? I don't know how you do it. It's an Olympic event. Brandon Brooks, I think, ran something like it. So he was a decathlete or something like that. But so in this event, you've got five different races that you're doing, right? You're running, you're throwing a discus, you're long jumping, you're throwing a javelin, and it concludes with a fight, with a wrestling match. And in this fight, you put on these hard leather gloves, and they were meant to protect your hands, but they would also absolutely maul the person that you were fighting. And so oftentimes this race wasn't just this grueling struggle, this really hard struggle that you had to endure, but it also at times was a complete bloodbath. Now, the author of Hebrews is using that to describe our life, an agonizing struggle, a conflict, a fight which demands our blood. Aren't you glad you came this morning? That is hard news, that is bad news. But in the midst of bad news, there is really good news as well. Look at our last verse, verse 11, where he writes, "For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it." Notice what he said there. Trained by it. Now, if you think about it, or at least for me, in a sense, that can really be comforting, even in the midst of our struggle. Because what he is telling us is that when you're struggling, when life to you seems like it's out of control, it's actually part of a plan. That there's a rhyme to it, there's a reason to it. There is a goal in mind. You are being trained by it. And so if we keep that in mind and we look at our struggles with this metaphor in mind, we can learn a few things, certain things in our suffering. Just as for an athlete, training is necessary for success in their game, for us, our training, our struggles are necessary for our success in life. And that is a tough reality. And that is one that we do not like. John Newton, who wrote the song Amazing Grace, wrote about this very thing, and this is what he said. "All shall work together for good. Everything is needful that he sends. Nothing can be needful that he withholds." Let that sink in. Let me read it again. "All shall work together for good. Everything is needful that he sends. Nothing can be needful that he withholds." Now, I will tell you that I, at the same time, love that quote and I hate it. Because when I read it and I hear that, it means that whatever heartache we all are experiencing, he's saying that's what we need most. And I don't like that. Because practically, as I shared when I started, what our life has been like, just as the author of Hebrews describes it, our life has been agony for 15 months. I would not choose it. I would not pick it for my family. And I have begged God to take it away. But he has made us sit in it. And so because of this, the painful reality of it is that what we've gone through, and I still can't even wrap my head around it, what we've been going through, what my son has gone through, is the thing that we all need most. And that is really, really hard. But at the same time, I love this quote, and I love this dynamic, and it brings me peace because it tells me that everything is going to plan. Even though my perception at times has been that life is out of control and that I'm getting overcome by it, God is telling us, it's okay. I've got this. I'm doing this to you, but I'm doing it for you as well. And if I slow down to actually believe that, it does bring me peace, even in the midst of pain, and I hope that it can you too. And you know, I'm coming to believe that The only way that we can get through our struggles and not be crushed by them is to believe this. We have to believe and have faith in God that He is in control in whatever we're going through and whatever we have, whatever we don't have. It's necessary, it's training, it's preparation, and that all is going according to plan. Suffering is never for nothing. It's never for nothing, and that can bring hope in really, really dark places. Now, I do want to take a step back, and I want to point out that God is not some sadistic God that just is sitting in heaven, doling out suffering and pain to His people. Yes, He does allow it, and He uses it. That famous quote from Genesis, Joseph talking to his brother, "What you intended for evil, God has used for good." And He will do that in our lives. It's part of His plan, but make no mistake, He hates it. The book of Colossians tells us that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. And so we can see how Jesus lived His life here on earth, and we can know that it reflects His Father's heart in heaven. In John 11, Jesus' friend Lazarus has died. And when He gets to the tomb, what does He say? Does He say, "Well, all things work for good. You know, it's part of the plan. It's just how we're going to have to go through this." Not at all. The gift we're given is the shortest scripture in the entire Bible, John 11:35, Jesus wept. Now here's the thing. That doesn't even capture it. Fully what's going on here. In the original language, the word used for wept indicated that He wasn't just sad, but He was angry. So much so that He was like a snorting bull. He was undone. He was enraged. He was heartbroken and angry over suffering, over death, and He hates it. This was not the original plan for creation. God's creation was not supposed to be subject to suffering and to pain, but because of our sin and rebellion against God, we are, and it does. It affects us. In this world, you will have suffering, but take heart, says Jesus. I have overcome the world. He is going to redeem it, and He is going to fix everything. He's going to wipe every tear from every eye. He's going to make all things new. So in our suffering and our struggle, it's part of the plan. Don't be surprised, but we have to ask the question, why? Why does He allow it? Well, you know, expectations are often the key to life. It's the way we approach life. So much of the pain we experience in our suffering isn't only the event that we are experiencing, but our inability to process what we're going through. As many of you know, a few months ago, my father had a heart attack, and he's fine, he's good, but it did require open heart surgery. And as he was finishing the surgery and he was in recovery, one of the surgical nurses came out to us and said, "All right, listen, I've got to prepare you for what you're about to see." And so then she proceeded to just give us this gruesome picture of what my dad could look like coming out of surgery. And she said that they recently had just started doing this because of how shocking it is to see heart patients post-op. She said that oftentimes they're gray or like greenish looking, they're close to death, there's blood everywhere, there's tubes. And she painted this terrible picture of what we might see. The reason she did it is she didn't want us to be surprised at what we're going to see. She wanted us to have either one of two reactions. The first reaction would have been, "Well, she was right. He looks terrible, but we're not surprised." Or the second outcome or reaction could be that we would see him and we would say, "Well, he doesn't actually look that bad. He doesn't look as bad as she described," which was thankfully how my dad was. He looked better than we thought he would, and it had everything to do with the expectations that that nurse gave us that we were about to walk into, so we wouldn't be surprised. So the question I have for you this morning is, can you approach your suffering and your troubles in the same way? Can you approach them as much that they hurt you, but you're not surprised by them? Again, this is why Jesus said, "In this world you will have suffering." The Apostle Peter, who was well acquainted with suffering, said the very same thing in 1 Peter 4, where he said, "Beloved, don't be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange were happening to you." So it's crucial that we approach our suffering in this way, because if we don't, our passage tells us that we can actually have one or two different reactions to suffering, much like we could have reacted to seeing my dad post-op. Let's look again at verses 3 and 5, where he writes this: "Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you might not grow weary or faint-hearted. And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him." So he kind of gives these two ditches here. He says that you can be weary or faint-hearted, or he said that you can take it lightly. So being faint-hearted is being fearful and essentially despondent, that all is lost. You're outdone. Everything is out of control. You're completely freaking out. But in verse 5, when he talks about do not regard our suffering lightly, that would be to essentially look at it kind of stoically, right? Just, I'm going to get over this. Not a big deal. Could be worse. Just to approach it in that mentality. Or, you know, it could be worse. At least I don't have it as bad as that person. Or you can say, this is not in the Bible, by the way, that God does not give you something that you can't handle. That is not biblical. He absolutely does. Neither one of these approaches is right, and we are told to guard against it. We are told, don't take it lightly. Don't be overcome by it. And the only way that we can do this is our second point. We need to recognize where God is in our suffering. And I want you to notice here what the author does, and I'm really thankful for it as I kind of learned what he was doing here, but he switches metaphors. And don't miss this because it's such a gift to us. In verse 5, we're told that we must realize as troubles come into our life that it is part of God's plan as he is God our Father. It's the way that God actually cares for us. Now, let me ask you this, and think about this for a minute. As you're approaching your suffering, what is more comforting, God as a coach or God as your daddy? God as your father. I don't need to tell you the importance of discipline in parenting. You know, as we seek to raise our children rightly, sometimes there just has to be consequences. In my almost 17 years as a parent, there have been many times when it's necessary for Kelly or me to intentionally inflict upon our children a temporary pain or discomfort to keep them on the right path in life, to learn boundaries or self-discipline or self-awareness or the proper way to live and act. And ultimately, we do this. Why? Well, because we love them. I'm sure you've even said it, or it was said to you by one of your parents, that I'm doing this because I love you. Now, sadly, that isn't always the case, because for us as parents, we are a mixed bag. And I know for me personally, there's been times where I have disciplined my children and I've been angry, or I've had my feelings hurt. Other times I've had really good motivations. I've had pure motivations. And it has to be a balance in between the two. Why do you think there's a proverb that tells us that if you spare the rod, you spoil the child? But at the same time, the Apostle Paul said, parents, don't be harsh to your children. Don't exasperate your children. And I know that we can err on both sides. But here's the good news. God doesn't. God doesn't waver. He's consistent and he's constant all the time. Look again at verses 9 and 10. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of the spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we might share in his holiness or in his glory. Even in our best intentions, we are sinful and we make mistakes. But God, as our perfect and good Father, knows exactly what we need best for our good, but ultimately to share in his holiness. It is actually our discipline, our trials, and our suffering that grows us in our holiness. You know, somebody told me one time that the best question to ask when in the midst of suffering isn't, why is God allowing my suffering? But instead ask the question, where is God in my suffering? And the author of Hebrews is telling us that in our suffering, God is right here as our loving and heavenly Father. And he is giving us exactly what we need for our good and for his glory. He knows what he's doing, and his only motivation, his pure motivation, is his love for us. And I know that on some level and on many levels, in the midst of suffering, that brings me a lot of comfort. Well, that being said, that life is a race, an agonizing, brutal race that requires our blood, and that God is inflicting it upon us in a sense so that we can grow in our holiness and grow in our knowledge of Him and of His glory. How do we run it? I mean, how do we get through life? What is it that we're supposed to do when we're handed a bill for something that we did not expect? Well, I'm really thankful that our passage gives us some really practical steps. In fact, it gives us really three practical steps and then kind of one big picture step. And so I want us to take a look at those. First, the first way that we can run a race, since we have this loving heavenly Father, since God is our Father, then by default, what does that make us? Well, it makes us children. And we need to humbly admit that reality. You know, when our children are young, when we as parents discipline them, they don't really understand. They don't really understand that the most loving thing that we can do as a parent is to discipline them. And a lot of times, we don't understand why. They don't understand why. And we need to remember the same thing, that we just don't understand. We don't have the mind of God. And we need to have the humility to admit that God is God and I am not. To go to Him and say, hey, look, I don't understand this, but ultimately, I don't understand. And because of this, I will trust. I will trust you. I will trust you even in the confusion. And at the same time as we trust, we need to obey. And that's the second thing that we need to remember as we walk through suffering. As the old hymn says, we need to trust and obey. There is no better way to be happy in Jesus. We obey, we endure, we stand fast, and we hold firm. You know, in suffering, I know I've learned personally that the easiest thing for you to do is to retreat. We retreat from prayer. We retreat from Bible study. We retreat from people. We retreat from God, or maybe even we retreat from eating. We essentially step back from life. And ironically, these are the things in our lives that we need most, but usually they're the last things that we do. And the author of Hebrews is telling us, don't retreat. Endure, obey, go through life. When Elizabeth Elliot's husband, her first husband, Jim, passed away when he was murdered by a tribe, the Aucca tribe in Ecuador, a very tribe that he was going to minister to, she didn't know what to do. She didn't know if she was supposed to go back to the States, if she was supposed to stay there, but she said that she wanted to just do nothing. She wanted to just retreat from life. And she came across a poem that changed her perspective. And I read it this week. And it's a great poem. It's a long poem, so I'm not going to read it this morning. I did put in your bulletin for further reading. There's a link through the Gospel Coalition where you can go and read that poem. But essentially, the point of the poem is, do the next thing. And she said that this completely changed her perspective, and it was at that point that she knew what to do. It was simply to do the next thing, not the next 100 things, not the next 50 things, not the next 2 things, but just do the next thing. Put one foot in front of the other. Don't retreat. Don't leave. The third practical thing we can do as we run the race is to do something that the author says in verse 2 when he says to throw off. Now, that sounds really odd, but think about it this way. All right, so when you go to the gym, what do you wear? You wear workout clothes. All right, you don't wear an overcoat. You don't wear a dress. You don't wear high heels or anything like that, or a jacket. Because normally when we wear those things, we wear them to, you know, conceal the stuff that we don't like. You know, to make us taller, to cover up stuff. But when you go to the gym in your workout clothes, in a sense, you see your true self. You see what you need to work out. You, in your workout clothes, you remember why you came to the gym in the first place. It reveals what you need to work on. Workout clothes don't hide much, and they reveal a lot to us. And suffering, like gym clothes, reveals a lot to us. It is the great revealer. Suffering often brings out the worst in us, and oftentimes it reveals things in our lives that we either hid or did not even know that we had. It can reveal to us sins like pride and greed, jealousy, lustfulness, and a number of other things. And it's in this time of being revealed these things about us, the dark parts about us, that we need to go to God and say, what do you want to work on here? What do I need to work on? Show me what it is in my life that needs to be changed. Suffering reveals so much to us in that regard. And lastly, and this is the big picture, we have to do that which is most important. The things that I just mentioned, those are techniques to help you navigate through suffering that come right out of our passage, but they aren't the power. In a sense, they are the engine, but they're not the gas. So what is the gas? And we see this in verse 2, where he writes, "Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted." He says, fix your eyes upon Jesus. And he has said this for 12 chapters. Look to Jesus. And why should we do it? Why should we look to him? What good does it do? Because he knows your suffering. And how does he know your suffering? Because he suffered. And this is the thing that separates Christianity from every other religion. Because we do have a God, and they sometimes have gods too. We have a God, but our God has scars. Our God has suffered. It was in Jesus' suffering that he redeemed us, and it's in our suffering that we experience our redemption. So how do we run the race? Well, we run it, to borrow the language from the author of Hebrews, for the joy set before us. That's our goal. The joy set before us. And we've seen this morning that our joy set before us is our glory, the glory of God, and so that we might become holy. But let me ask you this. Why did Jesus run his race? It said that he had a joy set before him, but what was it? Was it to become holy? No, he was already holy. Was it to get God's glory? No, he already had God's glory. What was the joy set before him? Well, Isaiah 53 tells us exactly what it was, where we read, out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquity. The joy set before him, the satisfaction of Jesus, was bearing our iniquities and making us righteous. Do you hear that? That is how much he loves you. That he endured hell so that you will never have to. We have to look to him. It was in his suffering that Jesus came after us. That's how he sought us. And he tells us, in your suffering, seek me. Seek Jesus. It's the only way to get through. It's the only way to run the race. You know, every month we come to church and we do this weird thing. We celebrate the sacrament of communion, which is essentially celebrating the death of the founder of our religion. But we do it to be reminded of what it took to recognize and be humbled by Jesus' sacrifice on the cross for our redemption and to grow in our holiness and so that we can experience more of God. This table, the sacrament of communion, is for anyone who looks to Jesus to be made holy. It's for anyone who looks to his sacrifice alone for your righteousness, not your moral accomplishment, and not even really how well you endure suffering, but it's for anyone who looks to the suffering servant so that you can be made righteous as he bore our iniquities. Now, if that's not you, don't fake it. Don't violate your conscience by doing something that you don't believe in. If you think suffering is random in this world, that there's no rhyme or reason to it, if you think you don't have a loving Heavenly Father who disciplines you for his glory and our good, then this meal probably isn't for you yet. Don't violate, again, your conscience by doing something you don't believe in. Instead, keep your seat. Nobody's going to judge you. Nobody's even going to notice. But instead, there's some prayers on the back of your bulletin that you can pray and think through and just begin to ask the questions. And I'm happy to process those questions with you. This church is a safe place to do so. So we're told that on the night that he was betrayed, he took the bread and he blessed it and he broke it and he gave it to his disciples and said, "This is my body broken for you. Take and eat in remembrance of me." And in the same way, after supper, we're told that he took the cup and he said, "This cup represents my blood poured out for you for the forgiveness of your sin. Take and drink." So if you've not been here before, it's our practice to come down and receive the elements of communion together and take them back to your seat. Just logistically, we found it easier if you come down the center aisle and then take the bread and the wine back to your seat. And then once everybody's seated and has been served, then we'll take the meal together as a community. The inner eight cups are wine and everything else is grape juice. There is gluten-free bread in the pre-packaged tablets or prepackaged cups. And so let me pray for us, and then if you're going to help me, Graham, do communion, you can come out front. Father, the suffering of your Son was your plan to bring about redemption and forgiveness in this world. And so we can know if you subjected your own Son to suffering that we too will be subjected to it. But this table tells us that we're not alone in it, that you know our suffering, that you came to this world and you suffered so that you could bring us home to be with you. Thank you that all is not lost. Thank you that you're not some clockmaker God who winds the clock and then just walks away. But you care about us deeply, so much so that you died. That you care for our families, you care for our loved ones, you care for the people that we love. And so, Father, I pray that this morning as we come by faith to take this meal, that you would strengthen our faith, that you would enable us to take our eyes off ourselves and turn our eyes to Jesus, the author and the perfecter of our faith, Father. And so now, Lord, I pray that you would take these ordinary elements and set them aside for your extraordinary use. In your name, I pray.